And so evangelicals really brought about the Victorian age and many of its values, its norms, its assumptions. And so even as Americans, we inherited that because we are, you know, we were part of or adjacent to the British Empire and so influenced by it. And that is the height of the Victorian age as well. And so an easy example, which I only talk a little bit about, but an easy example is just the ideas that we have about masculinity and femininity and the domestic sphere. Those were very important in Victorian culture, and we still hold to those, but they aren't necessarily biblical, or there could be overlap, but it's not purely biblical. It's very cultural.
Does doctrine really matter? The Apostle Paul once wrote to a young pastor named Titus, instructing him to hold firm to the trustworthy word he was taught, so that he may be able to give instruction in sound doctrine. Welcome to Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. Here's your host, Dr. Matthew Barrett, executive editor of Credo Magazine and associate professor of Christian theology at Midwestern Seminary.
Welcome to the Credo Podcast, where doctrine matters and theological ideas have consequences. I am Matthew Barrett, your host. Sometimes we need to take a hard look at ourselves, and by that I am referring to evangelicalism. Now, we have to also, be grateful. There are many ways that all of us, me included, have benefited from evangelicalism, but more and more lately, it doesn't take long to notice that evangelicalism is sometimes, well, in a crisis mode. Sometimes it's division, whether it be theological or even sometimes political and social. But regardless, there are certain strengths of evangelicalism that also become its greatest weaknesses. Now, there are many I could mention, but I think one of them that no doubt many of our listeners have experienced is this craving for power. And maybe I could even throw in the word dominion. Evangelicalism over the years has been so characterized by this pursuit, sometimes a very pragmatic, even business-minded pursuit of dominion. Dominion not just over the religious realm, but culturally in particular. And this has really defined everything from our churches to our institutions to the way we posture ourselves to the culture that is looking on. Of course, this turn towards dominion is not all that there is. There are other weaknesses that have accompanied this turn towards dominion, such as our history in the last, goodness, 100, even 200 years, in which out of the Great Awakening, but especially the Second Great Awakening, yes, there has been an emphasis on conversion, which can be, if articulated right, biblical enough, but at the same time, really a misuse of conversion, one that, again, takes a pragmatic turn in order to win souls or perhaps even manipulate souls into the kingdom of God, an emphasis that it, in its worst moments, focuses more on getting in than actually what we are converting people to. Well, I want really a bold, courageous voice to speak to some of these issues, which is why I've asked Karen Swallow Pryor to come on the Credo Podcast, as she has thought through so many of these weaknesses as one who has operated from within evangelicalism. She is the author of many books. If I could just mention a few to our listeners, you have to go read some of these. I recommend reading her one of her first ones called Booked Literature in the Soul of Me, as well as this ongoing series with B&H Publishing called Guides for Reading and Reflecting. In fact, we had Karen Swallow Pryor on previously to talk about Frankenstein, and what a great conversation that was. But I also want to mention her book On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Books, and most relevant for this conversation is her brand new book, The Evangelical Imagination, with a most telling subtitle that says, How Stories, Images, and Metaphors Created a Culture in Crisis. Let me just encourage you before we talk to Karen Swallow Pryor to, if you are drawn into so much of what she's reading, be sure to check out her Substack, The Priory, where she explores and engages British literature itself and why it's so incredibly important for our imagination today. Karen, it's so good to have you back on the Credo podcast.
It's so great to be back with you. Thank you.
Now, I have to admit something here, because when I picked up your book, The Evangelical Imagination, I was just flipping through it at first, and I was listening to Johnny Cash while I was reading your book. And sure enough, I come to a chapter called Empire, in which Johnny Cash is right there in the subtitle. And I just about fell out of my chair.
That is really funny.
But it's I kept waiting and waiting. It's like, okay, where is she going to get to Johnny Cash? Because I love his music, and I've learned so much from his life and biography. But towards the end, you really bring him into the picture in a most sobering way. But I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, because I'm going to give it away. I want to give you the opportunity, Karen. And this doesn't surprise me, because I often find your writing quite convicting and sobering, truth-telling, as I would put it, but yet in a beautiful way. And I find myself returning to passages you write, because it's not fake. You're very authentic and honest about the state of things. And if there was anyone to evaluate the state of evangelicalism, I think it should be you. You've taught in evangelical institutions such as Liberty and others, and you've for decades now, you have really operated in this whole world, and you've seen some of its strengths, but also not just seen, but experienced really many of its greatest weaknesses. And there's so many we could mention, but I want listeners to hear from you, because I think that you can speak to them in a way that really is firsthand. But before we do that, maybe some might be thrown off by the title. They think Evangelical Imagination, and they're thinking, C.S. Lewis or Tolkien. But you actually, the book, don't be fooled, listener. This actually is not that kind of book, though those, authors do, pop up. The subtitle gives it away, where you introduce images and metaphors to address how they are used and sometimes abused in our culture, specifically our evangelical culture, which I would agree with you when you refer to our American evangelical culture and say it's in crisis. Now, before we jump into it, what do you mean by metaphors and specifically imagination? How is that framing who we are, for better or worse?
Well, I start with the premise that all language is metaphorical, which, I can just say that, but if you stop and think about it, that's a lot there. All words are, signs that symbolize the thing that we're talking about. But we lose track. I mean, some of the things that we might say are obviously metaphors. If I say, life is a vapor, which is in the Bible, we understand that's a metaphor. But even so many of our common everyday things that we might say, like I'm going to run to the store, or the river runs through the woods. Run in both of those examples are metaphors, but we use them so frequently we don't realize that all language is metaphorical. And so anyone who's studied a second language or third or fourth language, comes up against this and realizes, there are different ways of saying things in one language. It's not just an equal translation word for word. So that's helpful. And I come from, I've studied languages my whole life. I've read books and stories, and my mind has been so formed by language and images and stories that I've come to realize this is just how I think. And it's also how I understand my own self and my social imaginaries, which is what I talk about in the book, drawing from Charles Taylor, that we all inherit these kinds of metaphors. We inherit these images or idioms, stories. A good example of a story or a narrative that we inherit simply by being American that we may not even talk about is the American dream.
Yeah.
It drives so much of our thinking, but we might not even realize it. And so what I'm trying to set up in this book, I try to explain all of that, but then show how evangelicalism also, like any other community, has its own images and metaphors and idioms and symbols and ideas that are assumptions we carry with us that we may not realize are assumptions until we stop and examine them. And so that's what I try to do in this book.
Mm. You know, right away you come out, and I knew you would get to this, but you bring it out right away, which looking back, I thought, okay, I can see how strategic this was. What am I referring to? Well, right away you talk about how Christian culture, specifically evangelical culture, we often think we're just Christian, or maybe, you know, especially to use the language in my circles, I just believe the Bible. You know, you'll hear people say that. But you make the point that so much of what we just assume is Christian is actually quite Victorian. What do you mean by that? And why does that so color everything we do and who we are?
Hmm. Well, if we are evangelical, then our roots are in England, and then, you know, over into America. There was an evangelical revival and a great awakening in America in the 18th century. And those movements were so influential and powerful that they actually sort of gave birth to the Victorian age in the 19th century, which happens not coincidentally to be one of my areas of expertise in literature. Mm. So this is also where this book is coming from. And so evangelicals really brought about the Victorian age and many of its values, its norms, its assumptions. And so even as Americans, we inherited that because we are, you know, we were part of or adjacent to the British Empire and so influenced by it. And that is the height of the Victorian age as well. And so an easy example, which I only talk a little bit about, but an easy example is just the ideas that we have about masculinity and femininity and the domestic sphere. Those were very important in Victorian culture, and we still hold to those, but they aren't necessarily biblical, or there couldn't be overlap, but it's not purely biblical. It's very cultural. And there are lots of areas of Victorian culture that we inherited as evangelicals simply because that is where evangelicalism reached its height of influence and power.
Mm. Now, you used the word power there. So this opens the door wide open. And we have, I think with that word, we have to take an honest look at ourselves because, goodness, it's 2024 and there are enough decades behind us now where we can see where things have been as evangelicals. Mm-hmm. The word power is so relevant because when you look at what evangelicalism has been about, I fear that for many looking in, some of the words that would come to them, their mind would be words like power, mm-hmm. a grasp for power, perhaps even a lust for power, if we could put it that strongly. Mm-hmm. Another way to say this is empire building. That phrase in particular has really characterized so much of evangelicalism. And with that, maybe we could add another word, domination. Mm-hmm. Now, in my experience, it can be a real cancer to evangelicalism. And maybe I should be more specific. It can be really hurtful to Christianity because you make this point. It's, I think, so profound when you say empires, well, they can often be built on coercion or trickery or deceit. They oftentimes are built around a network, sometimes the good old boys network, but they often revolve around domination rather than what Jesus was known so much for, which is love, especially with those who are not, who do not have that position of domination. Now, maybe some of our listeners are thinking, oh, goodness, this sounds, you know, dramatic and whatnot. But I think a case could be made that when you look at evangelicalism, this empire building enterprise, it's not just in the church, but it's really stretched its, you know, tentacles into political and cultural domination that has maybe less to do with the Holy Spirit than it does with, you know, building that empire. So let me ask you this question. Why has this been, given what you know about everything from the Victorian landscape of culture to British literature and so much more, the Industrial Revolution and so much more. Why has this been such a trapping for us, such an appeal?
That's such a good question. And of course, people who study earlier periods of church history and just world history can look at the Roman Empire and Constantine and those eras of the church and see similar patterns. For me, my expertise is in 18th and 19th century, which is where evangelicalism began. So I'm just really just starting there. But the reason it has such a hold on us is because that really was in our origins. That's our origin story. We have people who, you know, from the Wesleys, and I love the Wesleys, John and Charles Wesley, who had this found experience of the Holy Spirit and conversion when later in life, when they, you know, sort of had assumed that they already were Christians and then came to know that they were, and through no real intention of their own, just became celebrities and very influential, and other people followed their track. And so we have these people who are in positions of authority and power and influence of some kind that give birth to a movement, that so that movement has that kind of influence, and we've simply inherited it in the same way that, as I said earlier, we often inherit images and metaphors and language and traditions that we aren't even aware of. And so then we have the rise of the British Empire alongside the rise of the evangelical movement. And from the get-go, the interests of commerce and expansion were intertwined with the spread of the gospel and missions.
Yeah.
And when things are intertwined like that, it's very difficult to see where one ends and the other begins. Mm-hmm. And so we've inherited that as well. And so it takes a lot of unpacking to see, where the goodness of biblical truth is and where that got wrapped up in cultural values and norms, including political power.
Yeah. You make the point that it reveals what you call a deficient imagination. So maybe we could press into this some, because you mentioned just a second ago, which might surprise listeners, that so much of this grasp for power and dominion is wrapped up in our own history, and even our own history of missions. And this is especially sobering, right? Because when you look at the literature and the way that evangelicals sometimes would talk about their mission to reach the lost, it's wrapped up in colonialization.
Mm-hmm.
And there can be this rhetoric of we're the saviors. We're here to rescue you. We're here to save the pagan. You give a very chilling example of this, of what you call this deficient imagination, in a story Willie James Jennings tells in The Christian Imagination. Do you remember this story? Do you want to tell our listeners what it's about and why this is? Because I found this story to be so, like, pulling back the curtain, like, oh, wow, okay, here's a concrete example.
Yeah, to summarize it, and I won't do it justice, but Jennings writes this story of growing up in the Midwest, being outside as a young boy, working in the yard with his mother, and he's Black, his family is Black, and two white men come into the yard and start to witness to them and evangelize them and invite them to church. And Jennings realized he's listening to his mother talk to them, who tells them, well, she's a pastor's wife, and she works at her church, and their church is just down the road. And in this encounter, Jennings, even as a boy, realizes that these white men have no idea who his parents are, who are, you know, are well-known and beloved servants in their own church, and have no idea that they could possibly already be Christians just because of the color difference. And their imaginations didn't allow them to understand, you know, a sort of Bible-based evangelical Christianity that was rooted in a community of a different race. And I just think that we've all had experiences like that, or have been exposed to them, whether we realize it or not, where we assumed something about someone else's faith just because they look different, or their words are different, or their practices are different, but they can still share the same universal gospel faith that we do.
It's such a sobering story. I found myself thinking, you know, that it wasn't that long ago that that took place. And for many, it still does. Mm-hmm. It still does take place. It really brings to light that on the one hand with evangelicalism, it can have a strength in its emphasis on, say, conversion or activism, but that same strength can turn into a severe weakness in which we have this deficient imagination. We make assumptions. We assume we're the savior, and then we then proceed from that position of dominance as if the other party is ignorant and just blessed to be in our presence. So much of this, though, really, I mean, we mentioned. I know that you're an expert in British literature. How does British imperialism play into this as well? Because I mean, this might surprise people because for many evangelicals today, that's not exactly on the front of their minds. But it does come into our history at a very painful point. How would you connect the dots there?
Well, again, because the modern missions movement was mixed in with British colonialism and imperialism, it doesn't become disentangled overnight. I mean, I think even, you know, in the 20th century, the later 20th century, and even now, we're seeing how missionaries are really trying to change the paradigm for what they do. It's, you know, rather than going in and trying to rescue and save people, they're really trying to empower and equip them, which is really a very recent kind of transition, because that's how long we've carried this paradigm from the British colonial period. An example I didn't share in the book, but will always stay with me is, you know, I did my dissertation on Hannah Moore, who was an 18th and 19th century British abolitionist, friends with William Wilberforce. And it was just a few years ago when I was talking with an African-American Christian here in America about her and about abolitionism. And he said to me something that just really shook me. And I had not thought of it until he said it. And now I see things differently. He said, abolitionist, just because someone was an abolitionist didn't mean that they weren't a white supremacist or weren't racist. And I had just conflated all of those things, and I thought, he's absolutely right. You could fight a system like slavery, but you could still be a racist. And he wasn't saying this about, you know, any particular one of the abolitionists, but just pointing out that this can still be true, that the white saviors can do the right thing, but still carry that sense of superiority, or anyone could do that. Yeah. And that was eye-opening for me. And I think that those are the kinds of things we have to look at.
Hi, friends. This is Matthew Barrett. I'm interrupting this conversation to tell you about something quite exciting. Each November, we have a special meeting hosted by the Center for Classical Theology. This is an arm of Credo, and it's an opportunity to come together once a year in order to hear a lecture from a well-known theologian in order to renew and restore classical theology today. This November, Michael Horton will be giving this lecture, and he will be addressing us in San Diego, California, talking to us about what it means to affirm sola scriptura as it was originally intended, and how we do that in light of Catholicity. I look forward to hearing what he has to say, followed by a panel of other theologians discussing it as well. I hope you will join me in San Diego this November. Now, there is another side to this whole conversation. We've been talking a lot about mission up to this point, missions and imperialism. But there is another side, because as this story moves forward, you have figures like D.L. Moody who change the whole conversation, or maybe I should say they accelerate that whole program in a sense with what we could call a modern consumer capitalist mindset applied towards Christianity, and specifically American evangelicals. It's a long story, but you tell it well when you talk about how there's a business turn at this point in which outcomes are empirically measured and the principles of business, that business mindset is applied, in which suddenly evangelicalism must become a trademark. It's packaged. It must be promoted in a certain way. How does this propel things in a direction that really makes evangelicalism far more pragmatic in the end?
Yeah, the through line that I try to draw, and it would take more than the single chapter I devote to it, or even more than a whole book. But the through line is this sort of entrepreneurial spirit that really did underlie British imperialism and the slave trade, this idea of expanding business and land and empire. Well, entrepreneurialism is kind of the same thing, to expand one's own individual business or empire. And we saw evangelicalism be greatly influenced in that direction through D.L. Moody, I explained, you know, who brought the sort of business metaphor to Christian higher education that was later adopted by Jerry Falwell at Liberty, where I worked for many years. And even today in, you know, just the conference and publishing industry, which obviously I'm part of, but these are all maybe less dramatic and less extreme examples, but they still carry some of that idea of dominion and empire and entrepreneurship, expanding our own influence and power, and you mentioned activism before, and I fully confess that I'm, you know, I have an activist spirit. I have been an activist. I am an activist. I'm a truth teller. I'm all of those things. When I'm writing about these things in the book, I'm writing not only as an evangelical, but also as an evangelical who struggles with balancing these things in their proper proportion. Mm. So this is, you know, the struggle is real for me as well.
Yeah, Karen, I'm so thankful that you say it that way, because I think people could get the impression, okay, here we are just, you know, turning up our noses and looking down on others. But this is something it's real to our lives. It's something that we even struggle with to this day. And I love that about you, because you say at one point, listen, for years, I was one of them. you have this great moment and you're talking about this entrepreneur, business, pragmatic turn in institutions. Of course, churches as well, mega churches, political organizations, private schools, universities. I mean, we could go on. It's affected everything. And you have this one point where you say, well, religion that survives, if it's just based on, or if its priority is strictly activities and not faith itself, what are we left with? We're left with a religion that is merely institutional, one where you have an allegiance, but it's an institutional one. I know that there's a lot of harm that can be done at that point, and goodness, so many have been on the receiving end of it. As you look back over your career thus far, what would you say to some of our listeners who maybe they're seeing it, but they're just not sure? How would you warn them? How would you also advise them?
That's a really good question. And I think, again, for most of us who are in these circles, we have benefited so much from the way things are, and we've been formed by the way things are, and it's hard to see anything but the way things are, which is my challenge in this book, is asking us to begin to try to see. But I think we have to ask at what cost. And so when I talk about being a satisfied customer, it's because of an institution where I worked and thrived and became who I am today through that organization. And yet now along the way, I've seen so many who have been harmed, individual souls. And there's a cost that any kind of machine like that renders upon human souls. And it's not the kind of thing we can do with math. It's not the kind of thing that we can lay out in a ledger. And I don't know the answer to the question, but I know that at least beginning to ask it and beginning to see the things that we haven't been seeing is the beginning of the answer. Mm.
Yeah, you used the word soul there. And that word's so important because it really is a matter of the soul. And I think that if we're honest, we look back at the 20th century and we see how it's affected our souls. You think, for example, of Billy Graham and the Billy Graham Crusades. I mean, we mentioned Moody, but right on the heels of this comes Billy Graham. And what you've called a rugged, and others too, many others have pointed this out, a rugged individualism that is so emphasized in these crusades, especially in the conversion narratives. But it's picked up in other places as well, where rhetoric becomes everything. And you have, for example, Harding and his the book of Jerry Falwell makes this point when he talks about a factory of words, but then it raises a very probing question. Okay, is there transparency and honesty in those words, or are evangelicals using this factory of words now to shape and package and distribute things in a way that really gives them more territory for their empire? For many out there, this is their world. I mean, this was your world. Mm-hmm. You taught at Liberty. We've all, you know, to some degree, know others, or perhaps some people themselves were influenced by Billy Graham. How do you address this when it's so close to home? What would you say?
Well, having it be so close to home does offer me humility. It's still close to home. I still live in this community and have close friendships in this community. And like I said, my life has been shaped. And I think we need that humility. I don't think that our culture necessarily has it any more wrong than some other culture that Jesus came and died for. But we have our own particular ways of getting things wrong and our own particular blind spots. And maybe we do have some, because of the power and privilege that we have had, just simply by being American, maybe we do have a little bit more accountability that we have to reckon with. But I think that, these are the questions that every Christian of any culture and any time and place would have to ask. I think it's harder to ask when we are the ones in the position of privilege and power. We're sort of the default perspective, and that makes it easier for us to be blind to it. And so, again, I think that's why it can be harder for us to recognize underlying assumptions as underlying assumptions. Mm-hmm. But it's a task that all human beings and all Christians and all times and places have to do. So in that sense, we're not any different.
Yeah. Karen, maybe we can move the conversation forward by talking about conversion, because this is another emphasis in your writing. On the one hand, there's something to be applauded. You point this out, where we look back at, say, 17th century, moving into the 18th century, and it's a history in England in which, you know, if you are born and you live in a certain place under a certain parish, you are just assumed under that church. And there were certain negative consequences that came with that, both for the church and for the individual. How did, when we think of the best moments of evangelicalism this early on, how did it address that?
Yeah, of course, I do think of 17th and 18th century England and think of John Bunyan, for example, and other, you know, early Baptists specifically who wanted a re-emphasis really on the doctrines that were brought by the Protestant Reformation. And those included, you know, individual salvation and conversion, not just one that was automatically assumed, not nominal Christianity or political Christianity. something that I think we're seeing increasingly in our country today, so we can learn from them. So I am a decided Protestant. So of course I applaud this movement toward or re-emphasis on the individual conversion experience, because we do have individual souls. And yet, as I talk about in the book, if we emphasize conversion at the expense of other things or out of balance, then we can have false converts, we can have pragmatism, we can have lack of discipleship, lack of emphasis on sanctification, and all of those things. So it really needs to all be in balance with other biblical truths.
Mm. Yeah, it really is a complicated history, because on the one hand, like you mentioned, conversion, it rightly understood, is a very biblical emphasis. We see Jesus and the apostles. The apostles are laying down their lives in order to tell others about Jesus, and do so in a way that, you know, they're able to give an answer, sometimes against some very hard and serious objections from the culture of their time. And yet at the same time, there can also be ways we misuse this. You bring up the example of the Second Great Awakening. Someone like Charles Finney comes to mind, and his anxious seats. And the question I always ask myself looking back on this period is, what was behind this? And maybe you could speak to this for a minute, because on the one hand, there's this pretty radical emphasis on a free will decision that is not just something hidden within you, but at the same time, quite emotional, an emotional response. Tell us about, I mean, this might be that part of our history that we want to forget. What happened here?
Well, again, I think that there's just so much good in these intentions and these efforts to correct something that perhaps needed correction. But when we overcorrect, then we're left with another correction to make. And this idea of the anxious seat emphasizing one's free will decision and one's desire to be saved, those are excellent things. But if it puts too much emphasis on our individual will, which of course is not reliable, or too much emphasis on the emotion of the experience, which of course has nothing to do with our salvation, it's so easy for us to mistake those things for the actual event of salvation. Mm. And that's just one example. It's not meaning to pick on Charles Finney. The other thing that I draw out is how that approach can lead to overvaluing methods in and of themselves, like coming up with a new method that is new and therefore has some drama associated and some practical effects. And then when that wears out, you've got to come up with another method. Yeah. So from the anxious bench to the raising of the hand to the filling out of the cards to the coming forward, none of which have anything necessarily wrong with them until they begin to replace or become confused with the actual event.
Mm. Yeah, use the word balance, and I think that word really captures so much of what we're after here. Because on the one hand, there is this return, this good return to salvation, and is there an authenticity within someone's heart here? But at the same time, that overplaying that. To a point where, and you mentioned this as well, we're most concerned with getting people saved. And, if this is all we're about, then it tends to diminish or perhaps sideline formation or what in theology we would call sanctification. How, in your own life, how have you navigated that, especially in literature? Because I think when it comes to your expertise, British literature, do you see both of these extremes? And How have you used literature to try to correct that?
Oh, I love this question. There actually is we can see this throughout lots of literature, but sort of a paradigmatic example is a little war that developed between two early novels, one by Samuel Richardson. He's considered the father of the English novel, and he wrote this novel, Pamela, or Virtue Rewarded, about a young lady who maintains her virtue and is rewarded with a wealthy husband. But his approach was very methodistical, to use the 18th century language. He was very low church, and his high church Anglican peers critiqued his work for putting too much emphasis on chastity and on purity and on free will, the license, having a license to sin and being forgiven. And so the next novel that developed in response to that was a much higher church Anglican approach to virtue. And so we actually see, like, in the first English novels, which are known for their literary merit, but they reflect the ongoing sort of doctrinal battle taking place with, one extreme versus another extreme, and just studying those two works together and teaching those two works to my students together offers a model of sort of trying to find the balance in between those two extreme views. And that's just one example from literary history. And for me, that's a great value of studying literature, because good literature reflects the things that are going on in the world at the time, and also the universal human experience.
As we end here, Karen, I want to give you the last word, but I promised I'd bring us back to Johnny Cash. So here we are. You bring him up as well when he records a cover of Hurt. Interestingly enough, right? This is a song that was performed by Nine Inch Nails. To some, that reference may mean nothing, he really transforms the song in a way that was moving, biographical, sad, but also quite instructive, because he has this point where he uses this phrase, "Empire of Dirt," and to describe, some of his own regrets of what he was caught up in, what he lost in the process. You provide some really helpful commentary here, because you talk about how all empires of man are empires of dirt, and that you give us a warning. And I'd love to hear just your final thoughts on this, because you give us a warning that, well, if evangelicalism is going to look different moving forward, and maybe that's important to emphasize. I know that we've been quite critical here, but maybe it's important to look to the future. Okay, what could it look like? Well, if it's going to move forward, we have to realize that it needs to be something from God, not man. And you say, well, the kingdom of heaven, it's not an empire. And our first, instincts might be to react against that and say, no, it is. How would you move us forward in the right direction, Karen?
Well, just to go back to the Johnny Cash song, and I also highly recommend watching the video that goes with it, because it's beautifully done. He refers not only to the wrong and bad things he was caught up in as the Empire of Dirt, but also all of his wonderful accomplishments, his trophies and awards, and all of it is to him an Empire of Dirt, which sounds, very much like the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
And so I think that as evangelicals, it's so tempting for us to look at what we've accomplished, the good that we've done, the gospel we've carried forth, the institutions we've created, the wealth we've accumulated that we can use to spread the gospel and educate people. But those two, even the good things, are part of an empire of dirt when they become our own possessions, our own sources of pride. Things that we think point to our own power and ability, rather than belonging utterly and completely to the Lord. And I think that is where we've got it wrong. We have believed too much in what we can do, and not enough in what the Lord can do and will do through us if we let Him.
Now you can fill up on theology each day by visiting credomag.com. There you will find the latest issues of Credo Magazine with articles on key doctrines of the faith and regular video interviews with Dr. Matthew Barrett, where he answers some of the toughest theological questions of our day. Be sure to subscribe to Credo Podcasts to join the conversation, a conversation where doctrine matters.